Great. Okay, so originally I was just going to talk about this stuff with FBO and COO, but I think I'll just say a little bit about the bigger picture of what's going on in the face of the mountain. But really, this is not prepared in any kind of formal way. But, okay, you want me to draw on here. Actually, in terms of FEO, before I, okay, this is going to be funny, isn't it? You sure the blackboard isn't there? Okay. So, the phase diagram for FEO is probably not known yet, but the picture a few years ago hasn't been redrawn in any kind of significant way. But it looks something like this, where this is the V1 rock salt structure. And this is from a paper by Fay some years ago. And then Nittle and John Lowe found over here, actually, we don't know how this line goes here, but anyway, a Nick Larsenide-like structure, which was metallic. And that's at about, I think it was like 1,000 Kelvin and megabar, something like that, under GPA. And this is a rhombohedral distorted rock salt structure, which, as far as we know, is insulating. Though, I mean, that's what those experiments seem to suggest, that when you cooled it down, it was insulating. There's a lot of interesting things about this, because FeO, just plain old iron oxide, may be at the base of the mantle. It makes sense, because the core of the Earth is iron, and then the mantle is oxygen-rich, so there may be a significant amount of FeO at the very bottom of the mantle. And so if it's something, does something interesting, like if it's metallic, for instance, then that's very important, because that's an important boundary condition on a lot of things. And if also if it's metallic, its thermal conductivity will be much higher than if it's insulating. So again, that's important for thermal boundary condition for the Earth. So it'd be nice to know. And also, if FEO has a phase transition, then that will change the whole configuration of the phase diagram. And possibly, I'll show some slides of that, possibly change things significantly. So,
remind me of the picture right there, but what's the element B?
B1 is just rock salt structure. Oh, okay, so this is just like NaCl structure.
Okay.
Okay. So it's cubic. And actually, this line here, of course, doesn't, I mean, at low enough temperature, I guess it's the nail temperature. Forget what it is, like 80 Kelvin or something like that. Low enough temperature, it's rhombohedral even at zero pressure. Mm-hmm. And what happens is if you go up, this is say room temperature here, and as you go up in pressure, it goes into this rhombohedral phase even at room temperature. Now, the question is what happens here? Apparently, there's some evidence now that this thing curves around, so exactly the configuration of this region really isn't known. Okay, that this rhombohedral line actually curves around, and that it's maybe coincident with the magnetic phase transition.
Yeah. So what's the material above that looks like NiAs?
Yes, it's another. I'll show a picture of that. It's another crystal structure,
Nickel
arsenide structure. And now how this comes down to room temperature is not known. If you go up at room temperature, it just stays rock salt. That may just be because it's essentially quenched in. I mean, apparently from the configuration of the phase diagram, it should be nickel arsenide even at room temperature, but it's just never been seen, even up to like 2 megabars, which is kind of funny that you could push it on factor 2. Oh, you've got a real picture of that.
This is actually from phase RA.
Oh, real phase.
This is actually from phase RA.
Well, maybe you've got a whole set of these things that you
can. I wasn't going to use it, but it's happening.
Okay. Well, exactly this configuration here is not known.
Really.
I mean, so depending on the type, this diagram was put together from a combination of X-ray measurements and the shock data. But if you do just magnetic measurements, which don't see the structural changes, it seems to be coincident with this line. So this seems to be starting out with the nail temperature just going up with pressure here, and also the structural transition and the magnetic transition being the same. But the thing is, the magnetic measurements show that this thing bends over here, Very, but even in the rock salt structure, okay, so it's very confusing. I mean, even if you stay in this V1 structure, the nail temperature seems to go through a maximum and then start coming down again. So maybe it comes down right before this nickel arsenide line.
So a couple to elaborate, where the triangles and the filled circles are above 60 to 80 GPA, those are X-ray diffraction data. So those, right. Those are structural data that are older than the magnetic data Moranis was referring to. The shockwave data are older yet and say nothing about either crystal structure or magnetic state, but do document a change in electrical conductivity of several orders of magnitude. So the diagram really has been patched together from very different sources
of
information.
Right, and it's still real. Now the interesting thing is the base of the mantle is pressures right here.
Yeah.
Okay, so you see it's in a very interesting region. Well, first of all, it's high temperature also, so it's out here. So presumably it's in this nickel arsenide phase. And if so, as I'll show, that changes the, well, I don't even think I got a slide of it, but anyway, I'll just draw it. But unless you have one, it changes the configuration of the phase diagram, it's important for most of the lower mantle of the Earth. So
the only information about it being a metal comes from shockwave?
Yeah. No, well, there's also diamond energy.
In the same region.
Okay. Two different methods.
But what has never
been done. But they can actually measure the electrical conductivity in the static.
But what's surprising is never been done since then. I mean, that was done some years ago, 87 or something.
Yep.
So,
say it again, it's surprising, it's shocking, it's disgusting,
really what's needed is to see what happens, say, over here, you know, in higher pressures. And
high temperatures.
And there's a lot of questions, okay.
Absolutely.
So let me turn this off.
So what proportions of
this is just pure FeO, so it's just a compound iron oxide.
Yeah, but you have a stoichiometric problem.
Well, this is the experiments are done on real samples, so they're like 0.92 Fe approximately.
Yeah.
So you can even make a 0.98 or some people even think pure FeO at high pressure. But the experiments have been done just on samples from room pressure, you know, synthesizing room pressure that are essentially 0.92 most of the experiments. So the question is whether that affect. I don't think that affects the overall configuration of the phase diagram, though certainly it could move this line a little bit and things like that. I mean, in detail, it probably does shift things some, but not the overall picture, I don't think.
And the iron we find on Earth, then, so to say, is it in...
No, in the Earth's surface, it would be oxidized, so you would find, Fe2O3, you know, hematite, rust, or whatever, you know. Well, that would be hydrated. But anyway, but in the mantle, the oxygen capacity is lower than on the surface of the Earth, so it's expected to be, you know, in this oxidation. And essentially,
it may, of course, be a solid solution of that with NGO.
Right.
We need to come back.
Right.
Now I'll come back.
Talk about that later.
Yeah, now I'll show a diagram of that. So this is just a pure N network material. So there's really two issues: a solid solution with magnesium, which is probably the more important one in terms of, you know, the overall phase diagram. But the other one, solid solution, you know, with Fe3 plus and Fe2 plus is certainly important. And you can even have Fe3 plus coexisting with iron. But still, you know, at zero pressure, you have not stoichiometric FeO even in coexistence with metallic iron. But at the Earth's core, maybe it's probably, I think, the stable phase would be pure FeO, just because the vacancies get harder to stabilize at high pressure. So.
Okay, so that's more interesting for the core or for
the... Well, the very base of the mantle. Okay, now the core, it's liquid in the outer core, and certainly there's oxygen there, but I think looking at the properties of the crystalline FeO is not really going to tell us about the properties of the liquid iron with oxygen. But, I mean, certainly that's metallic.
Okay. I'm going to fill in a fair amount of the geophysical background motivation for this, but I think it's really fair to say that FeO has a rich history in condensed matter physics as being a real problem.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that.
This is, I think, one of the main
points. Yeah, that's the main part of my talk, really, but I wanted to put it in the context.
Yeah, that's good.
I'll give this back and ask it again if I need it. Thank you. Okay, let's see, do I have to push this? Okay, so this is I showed this last week, so this is just a three-phase triangle, the three most important constituents of the lower mantle or the bulk earth other than the core is going to be MgO, FeO, and SaO2. And perovskite is here, like MgSaO3, with some iron in it, and that's about, it takes up to maybe 10% iron. The exact limit of that is changes with the different experiments, but something like 10% mole fraction iron. And then there's this three-phase diagram here. Now, this diagram is drawn assuming that there's complete solid solution between MgO and FeO. MgO is in the rock salt structure, just like sodium chloride. And FeO at zero pressure and room temperature is in that same structure, and there's complete solid solution apparently between the two. So I think even at zero pressure, there's some possibility that there's a very small miscibility region there. But anyway, only because there's a lot of scatter in the data in that region, of like a little one scattering in the elasticity data. But as soon as you get a few percent away from FeO end member, it apparently is a pretty ideal solid solution. And now this changes, if FeO undergoes a really major structural phase transition on this corner of the diagram, it changes the whole configuration of the diagram. So I guess I need another my light thing again. So, because I didn't draw that either. So I guess I push that button. My drawing skills are, as you can see, not ideal, but anyway. So we have perovskite, we have this three-phase triangle here. But if there's a phase diagram over here, then that's going to bring up a miscibility gap here, and another three-phase region over here, or actually the way I've drawn this is not right. If we can have, yeah, that's right, I guess. Yeah, that's right. Okay. But the question is, how does this come up? We don't know. Okay. So it could just come up as, well, I mean, if one end comes over here, so that we have some solid nickel arsenide structure coexisting with silica over here, then the question is, what happens over here? I mean, it can completely change its configuration. I should have different colors, I guess. But anyway, we don't know what happens. I mean, this three-phase triangle could flip over this way. Or other things could happen. You know, it could get so stable that even perovskite disappears from the phase diagram, for example. And then you just have silica plus two different MgFeO phases. So one possible very base of the mantle phase diagram would be just something like this, where you have a three-phase triangle here and then perovskite. So it's pretty important, since perovskite is the most abundant mineral in the lower mantle, just a change in this end member could even make it unstable, so that you had no perovskite at all. Okay, so anyway, there's a lot of, in spite of its importance, it's really not all that much new stuff on it lately, though I'll show you a little bit of what there is. Okay, but first, let me talk about some of the other things. So I'm not gonna just talk about the FeO problem. So I showed that phase, that triangle. Okay, so you could also have phase transitions up here at the silica end. So if you have a phase transition at the silica end, then that would also lower the free energy of that end of the triangle, and possibly drive out perovskite from the phase diagram. And apparently there is phase transitions in the silica end member. The first one I talked about last week is this dishplate calcium chloride structure. That happens at room temperature about 45-50 GPA, but what we don't know is at the base of the mantle, 130 GPA, what temperature it happens at. Okay, so it could, the little bit that's been done on that suggests that at the temperatures of the lower mantle, the pressure will get pushed up so that it could happen towards the very base of the mantle. It's an accident that all these things would happen, at 100 to 130 GPA. I mean, the Earth could have different pressure scale, just a little different size, and they wouldn't necessarily happen right at the bottom of the mantle. But that's where it may be. But this actually is interesting. The calcium chloride alpha lead oxide at room temperature seems to happen about 80 GPA. So this SiO2 structure, which is in this calcium chloride structure, goes. By the way, you see these different chemical things. They just, of course, signify different crystal structures, and it doesn't mean there's any lead in the silica, it's just another crystal structure. But based on this structure that we see at low pressure, this alpha lead oxide structure, this apparently is seen in experiments now too, and also in meteorites. So So there is a possibility of silica changing its structure at at that pressure range. Okay, another thing is there could be something happening in perovskite itself. That's a little bit, actually there's some recent theoretical work of Boris Kiefer and Stixrud, where in some theoretical calculations they actually saw a phase transition not to a cubic or a tetragonal phase, but to another orthorhombic phase. And it's kind of interesting because it may be hard to see in experiments if you were just looking at lattice parameters. You may just see a little glitch in the lattice parameters at high temperature. But such a transition could happen. I say it seems unlikely, but apparently there's some evidence that it may even happen in pure MgSO3. But when you add other things like iron, calcium, or aluminum to the perovskite, it's quite possible that such things could happen as well. So that's really an unknown thing. It may not change the phase diagram much if that did happen. But on the other hand, it may change elastic properties of perovskite significantly. A more severe thing would be, that, as I've mentioned a couple times before, a perovskite actually breaks down. And there's been some theoretical calculations on this using a variety of different methods, and they just show the free energies to be very, very close. If you do a calculation of alpha lead oxide SaO2 plus magnesium worcestershire, even assuming no phase transition or funny stuff in the magnesium worcestershire, you get essentially the same free energy that you do for the calculations for perovskite. So it's very hard to tell whether you'll get one or the other. This is only high temperature I'm talking about. So at high temperature, at 2000 Kelvin, it's a very, very close call between the two. And there's a different experiments. Some years ago, Charlie Meads thought he saw evidence of breakdown of perovskite to stishovite and magnesium worcestershire. And then more recently, Saxena et al. Have gone in length and said that they reversed this transition. I think that especially if you read this long paper here, that they have a fairly good case for it, but my experimentalist friends don't necessarily agree with that. But I'm not sure why, but maybe that's something we could talk about.
It's not that reproducible.
And well, they say they can reproduce.
No, I know. I'm not saying they're wrong, but as you list further down, it's
right.
Not that reproducible.
Right. Now, their argument is that these people have not looked in the same PT range that they looked at. So, they draw a phase diagram where only their data is in the range where they say there's a transition. So, I don't know. I think it's still open.
I agree with you, by the way.
Okay. And really, it's another shame that there isn't some more attacks on this region, where they've looked at. But anyway, I mean, I guess it'll be done, but still, it hasn't been so far. So you have basically one group that has done a lot of work on this and says they see it reproducibly, and other people are skeptical. Okay, so.
Now, what does it mean after the Mao et al. Perovskite stability? How did they decide that experiment?
I think this is based on also fitting a free energy model, if I remember correctly.
So it's partly a theoretical
model. Yeah, not a first principles theoretical model, but fitting the available experimental data to a simple phenomenological.
And these are all pure N-member MgSO3?
Actually, I think maybe they actually have an experiment where they tried to measure the edge of that three-phase
right.
diagram also directly and said they saw it shift in such a way that the perovskite became more stable at higher temperatures rather than less stable. So, anyway, that's the situation. I mean, it's kind of open.
Is there any argument that one can make about the role of iron, that is, does it make it less or more?
As far as can be seen, it doesn't change.
I mean, obviously, yeah. The iron doesn't want to be in the perovskite, it wants
right.
to be in the magnesium
right.
worcestershire. But
right.
does that therefore translate into lower stability of the perovskite?
Well, if you look at the phase diagram, I mean, actually, there's not. Okay, I'm really. Let's see, I'll draw this again, but actually it's already over here. You see, this is basically an iron stability is how far this thing comes out here.
Yeah.
So probably before it disappears, this side of the triangle moves to the left and you get less iron rich stable before it disappears from the phase diagram altogether. It doesn't have to be that way. It could pull off to the right end and you could have a region where pure MgSO3 was unstable. But if it was a small region of perovskite left, But as far as it can be told from the experiments, at least the papers that I've read, it's hard to distinguish, say, the phase diagram or other properties depending on the exact iron composition. If you do an experiment on pure MgSO3 versus say, take a natural enzatype with more iron. Of course, if you put a lot of iron in, you end up in this three-phase deal here. But no. But if you try to make just pure perovskite, I don't think there's any evidence that there's any significant change either in the equation of state or stability. But there are disagreements in the literature exactly where the solubility limit is. It's a hard thing to prove. I mean, because you could probably metastably make more iron-rich perovskite that is actually stable. And to reverse things in, you know, the dominant anvil cell is hard. Now, in the multi-anvil apparatus, you can run for longer, but even there, I think that it's just not completely clear exactly what the limit is there. So it goes, I think it's more like 12%, but some people have said up to 20%, but that's probably, you know, metastably too iron-rich. So if you take like a pyroxene or glass that has 20%, as I understand it, 21% iron in it, you can convert it into a single phase perovskite. But the question is that really stable, or are you sticking out into this three phase field? If you waited long enough, you would form also a less iron rich perovskite, let's say, using a list of things. So,
yeah. I'm sure Ray's told us this, but what is the peak pressure that you're going to attain in the diamond cell?
Oh, well, far beyond the pressure of the lower mantle of the Earth. So, I mean, people have claimed up to 5 megabars. But useful data has not come from anything above, I don't know what, 250 or something.
Yeah, and high temperatures in particular.
And, but, you know, the higher you go, the more diamonds you go through and so forth. So,
well, and there's also something very intrinsic that I tried to touch on a couple of weeks ago, which is that basically you trade off sample size in going up in pressure and temperature. And that's at the heart of a lot of this controversy about reproducibility, because as people do more and more sophisticated experiments at more and more extreme conditions, they're looking at really tiny samples. And there are some very significant issues about gradients in temperature, gradients in pressure, that is, shear stresses, all these things worry the experimentalists tremendously about the reproducibility or lack thereof. So Ron's comment about you can synthesize something, you find it there, you can prove that it's there, but it may actually be metastable. It might have sort of accidentally formed, is absolutely right on. That's the kind of thing that we worry about a huge amount in the community. And that's why a lot of these issues aren't yet resolved, even though they're well in the nominal range of capability of the tools.
Though it is true also, at least I should say what I've been made to understand, that experiments above a megabar are significantly more expensive just in terms of diamond breakage and so forth than below a megabar.
So
the problem is this pressure range of like 130 GPA is in the expensive range. And if you're going to go break your diamonds, maybe you'd rather study something to 2 megabars that totally has nothing to do with the Earth, mate. You know, I mean, in other words, it's an expensive experiment, and so people would rather expend their. So you see, I showed it last week, a plot of where all the experiments were for perovskite, and you can see most of them were below a megabar, you know, and really that's the reason. And also the multi-anvil apparatus really only goes up to the bottom of the perovskite stability field, so it's about like 25 GPA. So you can make you can study perovskite in a multi-anvil apparatus, but you can't go up to, you know, 130 GPA with it or something like that, at least as far as I know.
How do you know the composition, the global, like how much Mg or Fe or oxygen there should be in the lower?
Oh, in the Earth. Well, that I should let Dave talk about that one. But I mean, basically the idea is that the Earth is chondritic in composition, so we have an idea of the bulk composition of the Earth, and we know things about the composition of the upper mantle. From essentially igneous petrology, largely, but you know, study of magmas and plutonic rocks also, and experiments to show what kind of composition you would need to make those melts, and that's consistent with chondritic composition for the Earth. But the idea of the mantle's composition then is this model of ringwoods called pyrolite, which is not chondritic, and you can make it by essentially extracting the iron core from the rest of the Earth, and which we know is there, and it's mostly iron, and we have an idea of how much it's not iron by its density compared to the density of iron. And then people even worry about minor and trace elements in terms of how they would compare with meteorites by looking at rocks on the Earth's surface and figuring out what kind of melting you would need in order to get that and so forth, and how much of those elements may have gone into the core. So actually, it's a whole field of geochemistry, really, to figure out what the Earth's composition is, and it seems like it's in pretty good control. But of course, like in a region where things are changing, like on the Earth's surface or at the very bottom of the mantle, the composition may not be the same as the bulk composition of the mantle of the Earth. You know, I mean, and that's one of the things of interest is, you know, certainly it's likely that the very base of the mantle is called D double prime. It's really a label from seismology, but that's a very heterogeneous region in terms of sound velocities and scattering and so forth. So there's clearly stuff down there. And there's a lot of different models of what's there, and I think probably they're all correct. So maybe this is something we should talk about today. I'm not prepared to really talk about it, but the kind of things that might be there is, you know, we know that there's this subduction going on at the surface of the Earth, and one of the ideas is that some of this stuff just keeps going and gets piled up at the very bottom of the mantle. So that would be a compositional thing that comes from, you know, silica-rich stuff coming down from the surface of the Earth. And then there's also the idea that you may, because you're close to the core, that it may be iron-rich. And in fact, Rick Raymond has pushed that a lot. Okay. And then you may have phase transitions, which is the really thing I want to concentrate on, which even if the composition doesn't change, you may have phase transitions in the materials of the mantle in that region. So there may be a lot of... Oh, and the other thing that can happen is you can have melts in the lower mantle that are denser than the crystal, and they may go down rather than come up. And so you may have pooling of melts down at the bottom of the mantle. So you've got all these different things possibly going on there. So the lower mantle of the Earth in general is pretty homogeneous. I mean, you can just take an adiabatic gradient and understand basically everything about most of the lower mantle. I mean, there's people that argue about it based on geochemical arguments, really, but there being some kind of compositional layer in the lower mantle itself, which I think is probably not right, but anyway. But and when you get to the very bottom, there may be all kinds of complex stuff going on.
So basically, it's chondritic, but you've removed most of the iron.
In terms of the bulk, yeah, in terms of the Earth's mantle, yes. And then taking volatiles out, you know, and so forth, too, yeah.
But like oxygen, you keep the oxygen that was in the silicates. You never form, for example, O2 that will escape.
For reasonable formation conditions of the Earth, most of the oxygen arrives bound in silicates. And oxygen, of course, is the most common atom in the Earth. Doing an oxygen inventory is not actually that helpful because it's such an overwhelmingly dominant element. So you can always stuff a little bit in the core and you can have a little. The only oxygen you might lose would be the volatile, the amount carried by volatiles like water and CO2. But even there, you're talking about such a small amount at the percent level that, you know, when you do an inventory, you can't really keep track of that oxygen. We're better off trying to figure out how much hydrogen the Earth has. We don't know that either, by the way. Now, silicon is an interesting one because there are, as you probably know, there are some people who are now advocating silicon in the core. And that's an interesting argument because when you look at the materials that condense in the solar nebula, it does seem that they have a different magnesium to silicon ratio than the part of the Earth we know, which is the upper mantle. Specifically, the magnesium to silicon ratio in the Earth appears to be higher by 10 or so percent. In other words, the solar nebula tends to make MgSiO3, that's basically what I'm saying, whereas the Earth is closer to Mg2SiO4. In terms
the
of the upper mantle. We don't now. So one possibility of several possibilities is that the silicon in the core, and you actually have to put quite a bit into to explain that discrepancy, which requires that the Earth be very reducing actually. in terms of the conditions during core formation.
Okay. Silicon in the core is the basis of Buffett's argument for the sludge or the sediment.
No, the silicates. It's actually oxygen in the core primarily.
I think the oxygen.
We'll talk a little bit about that if you want. Actually, I'm going to cover a lot of the background material.
Oh, good.
So maybe you want to charge ahead on the bonding.
Yeah, we're not short of time. As long as people are interested in discussing things,
absolutely.
Discuss it, because we have a whole week, and I don't think there's that much scheduled for the whole week, right? So
we're going to someone just.
Okay, I'm glad to make it short too. So
you mentioned that oxygen is the most common element in the Earth. Which I actually didn't realize that. But what's the
by number?
Okay. What's the ranking of the first five elements, most common elements?
It's good Earl's question.
Well, I know which ones, but I'm not sure I know which ones.
I don't know.
I mean, there's magnesium, silicon, iron.
So oxygen comes first, and then
oxygen comes first,
and then silicon, magnesium. Silicon, magnesium, iron. After that, it really drops down quickly.
Right. Sure. Okay.
But I think where you put iron depends where you come to the mantle of the whole Earth. I mean, iron is probably third if you
Or
second, third?
No, it's third or fourth, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, by number.
Yeah, by number. By mass, it's more.
So you don't have that much carbon and nitrogen?
No, that's one of the things, is that those are way down. And of course, you know, compared to real planets, to big boy planets, you know, it's especially the light elements, hydrogen and helium, that is totally depleted. That goes without saying. But if you look at it from that point of view, it looks like you actually have depletion. So this is sort of the inverse of what Dave was saying. You could interpret the patterns of abundances as having a depletion that eats all the way through oxygen. One interpretation of the data is that oxygen itself is depleted. Numerically it is. The interpretation is whether you say it's a high magnesium ratio or a low oxygen abundance, it's a matter of semantics to some degree, and it gets further complicated by the fact that almost all of these comparisons for historical reasons are made against silicon, 10 to the 6 silicons, right? And so how you factor in the silicon abundances is another complication. But it really does look like it's not just hydrogen and helium, but well into the periodic table, but there's a certain amount of depletion. And the difference being the hydrogen and helium is orders of magnitude, whereas we, for the rocky planets, tend to worry about percent and 10% effects.
So I mentioned about the possible phase transition in magnesium-wustite. And so magnesium-wustite is just the name for the solid solution here. And FeO. So the one I mentioned really before was this nickel arsenide transition. But there's other things going on too. I mentioned also this rhombohedral transition, which at low pressure appears to be just the nail transition. It's not clear whether that's the case at high pressure or whether that's a structural transition in its own right. We did calculations that were completely non-magnetic and found this rhombohedral distortion, so that suggests that there's a structural origin for this distortion even beyond the magnetic case or the magnetic driving force. And one thing I've spent a lot of time working on is the possibility of a high spin, low spin transition in FeO, which is a magnetic phase transition, which would go from a magnetic insulating phase to a either non-magnetic or a lower magnetic metallic phase, even in pure, even in the rock salt structure. So I mentioned these things already, these possible phase transitions that may happen in the iron region. So the pressure range there is between 80 and 135 GPa, where things may be going on, but we don't know exactly the temperature where each of those things happens. Okay, so the rest of the time I'm going to talk particularly about FeO and COO, and this is really work in progress. I mean, I can't tell you that we understand FeO yet. FeO and cobalt oxide are probably the two most problematic compounds in solid-state physics. I mean, they're the least understood, even in terms of their simple properties. They're very simple structures, and yet nobody really has a way of completely either understanding all of the data or predicting their properties from first principles and so forth. And there's a simple model for their behavior, which is not correct in detail, and and certainly does not allow one to predict high pressure properties. So I'll say a little bit about that. There's many, many different ways of getting the correct insulating behavior at zero pressure. The problem is that conventional band theory says that these both FeO and COO should be metallic, and they're not, obviously, they're insulating. And where the band theory breaks down to give that is a matter of some controversy. There's many different ways that we'll recover the insulating state at zero pressure, but if they're, so that's easy to do, actually, but one cannot necessarily trust them well enough to predict where that's going to change as you compress it. And so that's really what I'm particularly interested in, is the high pressure behavior of both of these, really, is a good test of the different theories that have been proposed, because they all make different predictions for their high pressure behavior as to whether they'll undergo, for instance, metal insulator transitions or not, and then quantitatively what pressure or what density that they'll undergo that. And there's a number of different transitions that can happen. There's magnetic transitions. You can go from an anti-ferromagnetic insulator to a either non-magnetic or low spin or even ferromagnetic insulator or metal. You can have metal insulator transitions, and that can happen regardless of the magnetic transition. So one can have an anti-ferromagnetic insulator going to an anti-ferromagnetic metal. There's questions about equations of state and the strain. I told you about this rhombohedral strain, but in cobalt oxide, there's actually more complicated strains that take place. And there's some experimental data. I'm not sure if it's been published ever, but Dave Mao and Henley found that, that there's even some lower, I don't know if they ever published that, anyway, some lower symmetry strains as well. But it's not clear what they are. And the other thing is that even though there's been a fair bit of experimental work on these systems, well, more on FeO than on COO, really I'd say the experimental situation is not settled. I'll show, I do have some of this experimental stuff here. So this shows MOSFAR data from Pasternak et al. I think Raymond's on here, right? So I'm not gonna give you a hard time. It's fantastic data, it's just a matter of interpreting what it means, okay. So, and that's a matter that nobody knows. I mean, I don't have a good answer for you either, but let me just show you what they see. So what they see is, and this is, you can see here maybe Fe 0.94. Okay, so to that question, it's not all 0.92, but anyway, close, okay? 0.940. And this is the MOSFAR spectra in situ in the diamond anvil cell at room temperature as you change the pressure. And so at low pressure, like 60 GPA, you see this magnetic signal, which is similar to what you would see even at zero pressure. It looks like an anti-ferromagnetic ordered material. And well, at lower pressure and low temperature, I guess, so you would have to be below the nail point to see this. And then as you raise the pressure, you see you start losing these magnetic, I don't know what they're called actually, magnetic sidebands or whatever they're called. And just get a central peak here, which is which indicates like a high spin to low spin transition as one goes up through to 120 GPA. Now, this experiment is done at room temperature, and I don't know that there was actually X-ray data in this experiment, but comparing with other experiments, the implication is that this is remaining in the rock salt structure, though it's probably undergoing this rhombohedral distortion. But not going to this nickel-arsenide phase, probably. I mean, and then this also shows effects of temperature at 120 GPA. So at 120 GPA, 76 Kelvin and 190 Kelvin and 300 Kelvin, and here you see at low temperatures you have this magnetic signal, and then as you go up in temperature, you're losing it. Okay, their interpretation of this is that this is actually a high spin, low spin transition. Okay, and part of the, I don't know if it was part of the impetus or not, but anyway, earlier there were some calculations that Maz and myself did that suggested this very pressure range of high spin, low spin transition. So it seemed like theory and experiment were more or less consistent. That was just using conventional band theory. Another possible interpretation of this, which is I'll show you, I think is maybe, well, we don't know what the correct answer is. Another possible interpretation of this is that you're really going through essentially a magnetic ordering here, and that you're still high spin, but then as you raise the pressure, you're going across the Neal temperature, or the Neal line, and essentially just like you go up in temperature, like here, if you go up in temperature, then you disorder the spins, and similarly, if you go up in pressure, you disorder the spins. So that's another possible interpretation of the data. And for example, if you were to look at FeO or cobalt oxide at zero pressure, and start at low temperature below the Neal temperature and raise the temperature, you see something similar to this. So I think maybe I'm going to figure that much. I'm not sure I do. Anyway, now this is different data. This is based on X-ray emission in the synchrotron at high pressure in situ. And what is seen here is the satellite peak here is related to whether it's high spin or low spin or not. So this is data in the same kind of, well, actually the pressure range goes here from 0 to 145 GPa. And the different lines here are different pressures. And this is Bondro et al. And they see this this peak here, even up at the highest pressures. So they claim then that it's remaining high spin, even up to the highest pressures, even over the pressure range we just saw with the MOSFAR. So this would be consistent with the idea that I just said, that maybe what's seen in the MOSFAR experiment is magnetic ordering rather than a high spin, low spin transition. And if you look at some materials that do undergo high spin, low spin transitions, you actually see this peak go away. So like FeS2, which is low spin, you see there isn't that peak there. And in the case of Fe2O3, at low pressure, you see this peak, and at high pressure, the peak goes away. So the same experiment can see this high spin, low spin transition in other things. So really, they're sensitive to different things. I mean, the MOSFAR is sensitive to magnetic ordering, really. And if you have a high spin, low spin transition, you'll see the loss of those magnetic peaks because you've lost the ordering, or because you've lost the local moments. Whereas this is more of a local probe that just tells whether you have the local moments or not, and it seems to say that they're still there in FeO. So, okay, now I mentioned about this nickel arsenide structure at high pressure, and it turns out this is an interesting structure in its own right. Igor Mazin had this idea, and then we sat down with Fay and Downs and went back through the experimental spectra, diffraction data, actually, and found that the best fit for the available data was not this nickel arsenide structure, where you would think maybe Fe goes in the structure for nickel and oxygen goes in the structure for arsenic, which was kind of the standard nickel arsenide structure. But actually, another possibility is the opposite, an inverted nickel arsenide. Actually, it's kind of funny, because like Igor came to me with this, and he said, you know, which site is the, he was going to do some calculations with nickel arsenide FeO. He said, which site does the iron go in? I said, well, of course, it goes in the nickel site. You know, well, prove it, you know. So that's kind of how this started. And it turns out when you do theoretical calculations, they basically have like the same energy, whether they go one way or the other. And so what we found by looking at the data is you can actually understand the data best if it's a very unusual kind of polytype. We actually have both structures in the crystals. And you can actually, it turns out, put them together. So it's a very unusual case where you can switch the two atoms, the nickel and the arsenic, or in this case the iron and the oxygen, between the two inequivalent sites and still make a coherent crystal structure out of it. So here you see, here's the red atoms here, which are, say, iron. And then at this side of the structure, those atoms are the blue atoms. It's kind of hard to see, maybe, but you can see up to here. And then this would be the next bit of the where the red atoms would go if you just continued with the same structure. So the nickel arsenide structure is also known as the B8 structure. It's just a crystallographic nomenclature. So that this side is B8 then. This is just a key for this diagram here. And this side is this anti-B8 where you've switched the role of the iron and the oxygen. And then it turns out that the bit in between is actually the B1 or rock salt structure. So you can coherently make all three structures and in the same in a way that doesn't mess up any bond lengths or anything. And one thing I think this is interesting because it may explain some of the complexities in that region between high pressure and low pressure. It may not just be a simple phase line. One in principle can have all kinds of polytypic structures with different combinations of B8 and anti-B8 and B1. In fact, one can even have an essentially continuous structural transition here, as one just takes the B1 and makes these B1 things smaller and starts growing these B8 ones. Anyway, I think it's really an area of, say, crystallographic or mineralogic interest, but it may affect the behavior of that BO in that pressure range.
Are you saying that that's the thermodynamic ground state?
Well,
this peculiarity. I could imagine a finite temperature.
Yeah. Well, we're talking. Okay. Of course, these are made at finite temperature. So no, nobody would say this was the zero temperature solution. Though actually, when we did calculations on this, it had essentially the same energy as the perfect material. So it may not. So as soon as you raise the temperature, then you would start favoring these mixed phases from the entropy term. They have essentially
so
the same,
looked at
the
same. I mean, can you go to a circumstance where the B8 and anti-B8 domains become small enough that this has an important consequence for the entropy of the crystal?
Yeah, I think so, but it needs some study. I mean, it hasn't been done. I mean, it's really, you know, it's kind of a crystallographic curiosity. I mean, it may be very interesting. It reminds me of these, there's all these models in alloy theory that have to do with I forget what they're even called, but the like antiferromagnetically coupled planes. I mean, it's an idealized model where you have competing interactions and you can get all kinds of weird incommensurate structures and things. I mean, it's kind of interesting. I mean, the interesting thing is this is happening in the region now that would be, you know, equivalent to the base of the mantle. So there may be funny stuff even going on even if it's just pure material in that kind of pressure and temperature range. Anyway, this was based not on saying that that this was the stable ground state, but this is the best fit to the data as collected. So that, in other words, what was made in the sample was consistent with this. Okay, but whether that's the most stable structure, you know, well, clearly it's going to be temperature dependent. Okay, now the rest of the time, I want to talk a little bit about what the solution is from a theoretical perspective on understanding these materials. And actually, I don't know that this is the solution, so I'm completely nonpartisan. I'll explain what this is, but I feel like it's a good test for it anyway. Actually, the indications so far are that maybe it makes the wrong predictions, but anyway, someone should let us publish it anyway, even if it's wrong, because we need to test this. A problem with referees on this. We're not pushing this, but anyway, this is the best tractable method that is currently available. Okay, so what the idea is, I don't think I have anything on here that explains this really. The idea is that, you want me to write up here. Is there another one of these things? Are there different problems with these things? Oh, you've got a whole pile of things.
Yeah, I have some.
Okay, thanks. Okay, I don't even know what I'm going to draw here. I'm not wearing this, is that okay?
I don't think it matters.
You know, it seems
to be picking it up. Probably picking up something, but
maybe just the sound of it. I don't know.
So, right. Just a long, worrying sound.
So, okay, in band theory, let me turn this off. Most theory for crystals is based on band theory, and the idea is that you don't have electrons localized at a single point in space, but rather you have electronic wave functions that are extended. Okay, they don't just sit at a single point, but the electrons basically sample over the whole crystal. And many years ago, I think it was Mott, okay, considered the case of, say, a hydrogen lattice. It's actually important in hydrogen. I wanted to do some work on hydrogen with this before this meeting. It turned out that the code I was using divided by zero when you put in this effect on an S state, and we're trying to figure out what to do about that. But anyway, I mean, the theory actually divides by zero, so there's something wrong with the theory. Anyway, It's not a programming bug. Anyway, if you have an array of protons, say, and make hydrogen atoms, and then you throw in some electrons, if they're close together, then you get a crystal out, right? And so BCC hydrogen, when the protons are close enough together, you just have a metallic crystal. But what happens when you keep increasing the lattice constant of those hydrogen, you know, the distance between these atoms, so call that A, okay? So if you keep increasing it and you spread them far enough apart, like let's say you put one hydrogen atom where the sun is and another one where the earth is and so forth, clearly you don't think that the electrons are going to be in a single state, you know, single itinerant state traveling metallically between the sun and the earth or whatever, okay? So instead you expect to have just hydrogen atoms. And the problem is that band theory is not sensitive to that. If you do a band theory calculation, no matter what method you use, it doesn't matter, you'll always come out with a metallic solution for that system. So what it is there's another effect which has to be considered, which is really not considered in band theory. And that's that, let's say you have these atoms here, and let's say they each have one electron on them, so we're going to consider the electron to be localized on an atom. Then there's another effect, which is that in order for an electron to flow from one atom to another, it has to leave this atom and come up over here and come around this atom. Okay, now you've got just a proton over here, and then H minus ion over here. Now, the problem is when you do that, there's a big repulsion between these two electrons. This new one that you brought over here is another negative electron over here, and if they don't want to be near each other, they'd like to be far away. And so that's a repulsive term in the energy, which is known as U. Okay, so U is basically the energy it takes to take this electron from over here and stick it over here. So in normal band theory, the reason that's not included is you consider the electrons to be spread out in space in some orbital, and as you look at a macroscopic system, this orbital is extending to infinity, basically, and each electron is diluted by that amount, in fact, and so you're kind of looking at a smeared out electron that's smeared out over all space, and so the amount of repulsion with another electron is negligible because they're both in a wave function that's spread out over a very large space. But in reality, I mean, so that's the band limit. But in the localized limit, you have to consider where the electron is. You can't just consider it to be in a state of completely unknown position. If you ask where it actually is, if they're both on this proton over here, then there'll be this huge increase in the energy. And so there's really the two limiting cases. There's the localized picture where you know where the electrons are, and I guess you don't know what their energy is or momentum is, but you know where they are. And then the other limit where you know exactly what its momentum is, but you have no idea where it is. And they seem to give different results then for the system. And Mott, many years ago, showed that there was actually a phase transition between the band system and the localized system. And so that both were correct in the limit of either completely localized or completely separated, and there was a phase transition between these two limits. Now, how this carries over to more complicated crystals like FeO is really not known very well. But a method was developed, known as LDA plus U, in which, and I didn't really prepare this as a review talk on LDA plus U, so you'll just have to listen to me talk about it. There's tons of slides I could show on this. But anyway, which I don't have here. But anyway, the idea of LDA plus U is to just take conventional band theory and then tack onto it this effective interaction that's repulsive between two, adding another electron to a site. And so the idea is you have, say, an Fe2 plus on the site, and then you have another Fe2 plus somewhere else, and then you want to make it a metal, you want to have the charge flow, well then an electron will have to come over here, so this will temporarily become, say, 1 plus, and this will become 3 plus, just for, you can't think of it really as one plus. I mean, it's something that's happening dynamically. But the idea is that that's going to be kept from happening because of this repulsion of putting another electron on that site. Now, the problem is even conventional band theory contains something like that. But it's just not specific. It's not localized. It's kind of a mean field approximation to that. So one of the hardest things with this LDA plus U model is you need to subtract out the part that's already in band theory. And there's no closed form or simple way of figuring out what that is. So there's different models for how to subtract out that double counting part. And you get different answers there. So it's not really completely satisfactory. Okay, so what I've done is, in collaboration with Steve Gramsch and then using Sergei Zavrasov's code, there's other people who developed such code as well, use this LDA plus U method to study the behavior of FeO and COO at high pressure and see what they predict. And because we know that it's been shown already that they can give very good results at zero pressure. Okay, there's a parameter in the model, the value of this U, and it turns out there's values for J and so forth, too. Basically, you have to know what the different Slater integrals are. But basically, it's considered to be an atomic-like property, though we know U is actually less than what it is in the atom. But nevertheless, it's got this parameter in it, so you need to vary this parameter and see how it behaves with different values of this U. And in principle, there's a way to compute these parameters self-consistently within the theory. It's never really been done. What we did is use a value that was come up with a non-self-consistent estimate of what it is. We also, now, even though it has the word LDA in it here, it just means LDA in a generalized sense. I mean, we really did GGA plus U, but that's kind of the technical detail, okay? And then we also looked at just conventional band theory calculations for these materials. And we looked at cubic, rhombohedral, and tetragonally strained crystals. And one of the things that made this into an enormously complicated problem is it turns out that there's a multitude and maybe an infinite number of solutions to the problem. When you do band theory, normally in a non-magnetic system, there's just one self-consistent solution. And in a magnetic system, there's just a small number of self-consistent solutions, like you might get an anti-ferromagnetic solution or maybe two of them, and a ferromagnetic solution, a non-magnetic solution. In the case of LPA plus U, there apparently are an infinite number of solutions. And with it to be consistent within the theory, you should find the lowest energy one. But there's no systematic way of finding that. So it's kind of like an experimental situation where we kind of do it and then start with different starting materials, in our case, starting gases, and see what we come out with and look for something that is consistent. Now, there's some things that had already been done before, and I want to just briefly mention it because I think it's important. One of the things is, in spite of the fact that conventional band theory gives the wrong answer for FeO, it makes it metal at zero pressure, we went ahead and computed structural properties of FeO some years ago with just the best band theory available, and found that you got quite good agreement for the equation of state and the strain for FeO as a function of pressure, and also the magnetic moments and so forth. So it seems like some of the things are right even in the regular band theory. The other thing those calculations found was a magnetic transition, a high spin to low spin transition at high pressure at about 100 GPa, which is interesting. And I'm not going to belabor it because I don't really know what the answer is. There's some possibility that these calculations are actually more correct than the more sophisticated LDA plus U ones. I mean, we don't know yet. I mean, it depends on how you interpret the experimental data, too. And then I mentioned about this V8 and anti-V8 structure already. And there's been some work with LDA plus U and FeO previously, and also looking at, there's another complication in the systems is that spin orbit can be important, and one can have important orbital moments in these materials as well. And that's another reason it's taken us so long to do this. Okay, so this shows what the electronic density of states looks like in FeO if you just do regular band theory. And if you do, this is at zero pressure. And the blue here is, I'll call it spin up. It's the majority magnetic spin. And the red here is spin down. And this vertical line here, you may not be able to see, is the Fermi level. So states are occupied up to this level. And you see this line is right in the middle of a peak in the density of states, or in the large region of density of states. These are D states. And so band theory predicts it to be a metal because there's no gap in the energy spectrum in the region where the Fermi level is. So this is showing, I don't know if you can read density of states versus energy. Now, if you put in a rhombohedral strain into FeO, but still just do conventional band theory, it changes the symmetry of the states. You break off like the T2G manifold, and I may have some pictures of this, into singly degenerate and doubly degenerate states just by the reduction in symmetry. And it opens up kind of a little pseudo gap here, but it doesn't actually end here, but it doesn't actually do enough to turn it into an insulator. I mean, it's pushing things in the right direction, but not enough to make it an insulator. So it still ends up being a metal. And this shows what conventional band theory predicts then, again, not doing the LDA plus U, but just regular band theory, for the magnetic moment versus pressure. And again, it's very exciting, I think. It shows that in the cubic phase, you get this very strong first-order phase transition where the moment drops from high spin to low spin. Now notice the low spin phase still has some magnetic moments, but it's just much lower than in the high spin phase. But what we found was that if you put in this rhombohedral distortion, which is present in experiments and also is lower energy in the theory, this big first-order drop disappears and instead one gets a continuous drop in the moments. Okay, so we didn't know that at the time we wrote our science paper on this, but if you, this was for the cubic case, and then for the rhombohedral case, it drops continuously and slowly. The other thing is, one can also look at a ferromagnetic case, and you see it also has moments of drop, but you know, somewhat quantitatively different than the anti-ferromagnetic case. Okay, so I mentioned about this LDA plus U model. These are some of the references for it. What's important is that it's a Hartree-Fock approach, essentially. So even within the idea of electron interactions, it's not exact. And then the problem is that some of this stuff is included in this in LDA already, and so it has to be subtracted out in an average way. So what happens when you do it is shown here. Let's see. It turns out, I mentioned there are different ground state solutions, depending on what your starting guess is. So in the case of putting in a rhombohedral strain, and then if you constrain the electronic structure to also be rhombohedral, so you're constraining the electronic structure in your starting guess, then you get an insulating phase out at zero pressure, and the Fermi level is shown here by this, well actually it's at zero, I guess it's not shown, okay? So the Fermi level is at zero here, and you see now there's a band gap, and it's insulating, okay? So that's correct. And then if you go up in pressure, and again, assuming rhombohedral symmetry, then by the time you get to 120 GPa, you see it's metallic. So now there's a density of states at the Fermi level, there's no more gap there. So this predicts then a metal insulator transition as you go up in pressure. Note though that it's still magnetic. You see the red up spins and the blue down spins, there's many more of the red ones below zero than above zero, there are none. Okay, so it's still a fully magnetic anti-ferromagnetic insulator, but I mean anti-ferromagnetic, but it's a metal. Okay, so it's an anti-ferromagnetic metal. Now, we found a lower energy state, in some cases, I'll show a phase diagram for this, which is monoclinic in electronic symmetry, but still has a rhombohedral strain. Now, presumably, if we let it strain more, which was just outside our computational ability, we would find some small monoclinic strain as well. But nevertheless, there's an electronic monoclinic symmetry. It still shows a insulating state at zero pressure, but it continues to be insulating even at high pressure. So we've got an insulating state now that remains stable. This is cubic. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm pointing to the wrong thing. Okay. This one is rhombohedral. And this one is actually cubic, what I'm showing here. Okay, so if it wasn't for the fact that it was rhombohedral, okay, so this is just by itself here, I'm sorry. So at high pressure, if it were cubic, for example, because it was, say, high temperature or something, it would still be insulating. So it's coupled very much with the crystal structure as well, whether you get a metallic state or an insulating state.
Remind me again of the crystal structure on the left side.
Okay, this is this rhombohedral structure. You take just like a cube,
yes,
and then stretch it out along the cube diagonal.
Yes.
I don't have a picture of it.
Okay,
Okay.
And what's the zero pressure?
At zero pressure, same thing, just stretching it out. Okay, so there's no phase transition here. This is all at zero temperature.
Yes. Right, okay.
Okay, experimentally, at room temperature, it's cubic.
Yes.
But if you lower the temperature, it has its rhombohedral strain. Okay, now, I hesitate to show these because I don't know if this is the right picture or not. But this is a guy named Brandow, actually has a really set of excellent extended, maybe I have a reference on one of my slides, but has some really excellent extended articles on this type of phase transition. And he popularized these diagrams, which are basically Hartree-Fock-like energy levels for what's probably going on in these different systems, but from the very local point of view. And I don't know if these are correct or not, but let me just show you how it works out. The idea, nickel oxide is actually fairly easy to understand. Nickel oxide is an insulator. And one thing that's easy about nickel oxide is it's also, within this localized picture, a half-filled system. What I mean by half-filled is it has these five, I'll just go ahead with pull ahead with this, but I'm not sure it's all completely correct. I think maybe it is. Okay. Anyway, there's a natural gap in nickel oxide that's between these T2G states and these EG states. And in cubic symmetry, you have the five D levels get split into states of triply degenerate and doubly degenerate energy levels. And these are known just by the symmetry designation as T2G and these as EG. And in nickel oxide, you have just a natural distinction where you can just make a gap above these T2G states, the spin down T2G states. And how these different things like U and J and this crystal field effect all come into the model and are all something that in principle are calculated by theory and measurable by experiments. It's much more complicated in something like cobalt oxide, which is not half-filled. So in the case of cobalt oxide, where the gap goes is actually not all that clear. I'll show you in a minute that apparently in both FeO and COO, the LDA plus U theory predicts that the gap actually increases with pressure before it then turns around and decreases with pressure. And the only way I can understand that happening is that there's actually a change in this delta crystal field term within his model. But whether that's really the correct way of looking at the results or not, I'm not sure. Anyway, this would be the energy gap then between these different T2G states, which are split off instead of now being triply degenerate, they're split off because of this local interaction. And in the case of FeO, it's also very complicated how exactly to treat it and where to put the gap. And the same thing happens I'll show you, with the gap increasing with pressure and then decreasing. So this summarizes what we get for the equations of state. In the case of just assuming the cubic lattice, when you do a GGA normal band structure calculation, you get a high spin equation of state and a low spin equation of state and a strong first order phase transition between the two of them at about 120 GPA. But when you turn on the U, this phase transition goes away. So the equation of state for these for a system with this U on it shows no such high spin, low spin transition. And now if you look at the rhombohedral case, I also said that one has just a continuous transition. And again, it's just one doesn't see it also in the case with the U. Now, one question you might ask right off the bat is whether this LDA plus U method gives anything reasonable at all in terms of the equation of state. And it turns out that it does quite well with the equation of state. So it's not messing up things too badly. Remember, there's no fitting to experiment in here. If you do just normal, the experimental volume is 40.6 cubic angstroms per atom. And the experimental bulk modulus is about 160, say. And you see that all of these calculations, I won't go through them individually, basically give reasonable values for the volume and the bulk modulus and its pressure derivative. So really, there's no smoking gun here. I mean, the band theory does reasonably well. Maybe the bulk modulus is a little bit high. Volume's a little bit low, but actually it's pretty good for a first principles calculation. When you turn on the U, the bulk modulus does not really deteriorate. I mean, it stays pretty much within the range that's experimental range. So anyway, it would actually be good if one of these was bad, because then we could rule it out and say, this predicts a bad equation of state, but actually they are all reasonable.
But K prime,
It not really varies. So one thing. I just put a single number here, but I would say Cape Prime is not really that well known experimentally. First of all, it's hard to get Cape Prime just from equation state studies. There's a lot of reasons for this. And really, more needs to be done. It is possible ultrasonically to get Cape Prime out quite accurately, but as far as I know, that has not been done on FBO. The other problem is that the experimental samples are going to be like the 0.92 or 0.94 FE, and we know that affects the elasticity some, because people have studied how that varies to some degree with bulk modulus even. And all the calculations are being done for pure FEO. So that's another point of difference. All these calculations are pure FEO, and the experiments are on, you know, samples that are stable at zero pressure. Okay, and cobalt oxide, just to put in basically the same picture. So if you do band theory, you get a high spin, low spin transition. In this case, at quite low pressures. I didn't write the pressure down, but it's something like 50 GPa or 80 GPa. But when you turn on the U, and I have values for different curves for different values of U here, that transition goes away. And the experimental volume is 261. Here I have it in atomic units. And you can see that depending on your value of U, actually in this case, the band theory isn't great. But when you turn on the U, it actually gets better. And if you make U too large, the volume gets too large. So in this case, maybe there is some sensitivity to the equation of state where you can start distinguishing between theories. Also, the bulk modulus varies a lot over this range. So in the case of cobalt oxide, maybe there's more hope in distinguishing. So for band theory, this bulk modulus of 300, with U equals 8, 180, and you see the experimental is 181. But that is not the best volume, though. So I guess maybe this is the best compromise, that U equals 4. You know, if you were just going to fit it according to the experimental equation of state or something like that. The other thing that was very exciting about this is that the strain comes out very accurately with this LDA plus U. If you do even just regular band theory, it does a decent job with the thrombohedral strain, but quantitatively, it gives too high a strain. See, this the minimum here in this energy versus strain is about here, and the experimental strain is over here. So we're looking at it basically how much it's pulled out along that diagonal. But if you do this LDA plus U, this is for FEO, you see the minimum is in really perfect agreement with the experimentally observed strain. So that suggests that things are improving with this LDA plus U. And we have contradictory bits of information, but at least in terms of the strain, it appears to be. And if you look at the summary of the strain versus volume or versus compression, it really looks quite good. So this is the experimental strain versus volume. You see it becomes more rhombohedral as you raise the pressure. And this is our LDA plus U calculations. Maybe it's not in perfect agreement if it doesn't have exactly the same shape, but there may be some non-hydrostatic stress in the experiments. And also, we're doing our calculations at zero temperature, and these are done at room temperature. And if you do look at the LDA case, you see the strains are too high, though they do parallel the right slope. Okay, even more interesting is really the energetics of the system, the predicted phase diagram. What we find is at low pressure, the prediction is that it could be even cubic is very close here to with this rhombohedral symmetry with a cubic lattice, and then slightly lower energy is the rhombohedral strain. So that's consistent with this very low temperature, nail temperature in FEO. And as you go up in pressure, this rhombohedral strain line, this green line, becomes lower in energy. So that's consistent with it wanting to strain more as you increase the pressure. But then as you get up higher in pressure, in this case it's about 180 GPa, this monoclinic symmetry result actually becomes the most stable. So that may be consistent, it may not happen at 180 GPa, but anyway, there's some experiments that suggest some lower symmetry peaks in the X-ray spectra that may come in at higher pressures. So this summarizes what happens with the moments in the gap. It's a little confusing. The blue here are the moments. So we see that the moments actually, if you do band theory, okay, pressure's going to the right. If you do band theory, like I said, you get this strong first order phase transition in the cubic case. But if you do LDA plus U, this transition doesn't happen. And if you look at the gaps, you see the gap first increases with pressure and then decreases with pressure. So originally it even becomes a better insulator, and then it becomes tends towards the metal. As you get up to very, very high pressures, you see we're over 200 GPa here, and it's still insulating. That's for the cubic lattice. However, for the rhombohedrally strained lattice, we get a very different picture. For the band theory, we just get the moment decreasing the pressure, but the gap initially increases and then decreases. And depending on whether we have this rhombohedral symmetry or monoclinic, remember this pressure range in rhombohedral is actually the lower energy system, it actually becomes metallic at about 120 GPa. So it's really interesting, I think. I mean, this experiment really needs to be done. The implication here is that even in the rock salt structure, now I don't know how accurate this number is of 120 GPa, but it's really going to be 200 GPa. We don't think the theory is perfect. But the suggestion is that at high pressure, even at room temperature, FeO may be metallic, even in the rock salt structure. Let's see, I think I've taken enough time. There's a lot of details I'm showing here. Basically, that summarizes it. One thing I want to point out is this, though. There's another line of work, which is to understand simple lattices with simple interactions, but as accurately as possible, as opposed to trying to really include all the complications of all the D levels in that are present in, say, Fe2+, and then the hybridization with the oxygen and everything, to just take a lattice of point antiferromagnetic ions and then use quantum Monte Carlo on it and see what one gets out, you know, in terms of the phase diagram and other properties. And so that's been done. This is from McMahon et al. And so what it's actually a periodic Anderson model here, but they say Hubbard model here. But anyway, so what this shows is they plotted this with some, you know, like model parameters. But basically what it is the temperature you can think of as increasing on the y-axis here, and the pressure increasing to the left on the x-axis. And this is the phase diagram they come up with. First of all, if you do just like a Heisenberg kind of interactions between spins on sites, you would get this phase line, with this being the nail temperature, and you would find that the nail temperature increases with increasing pressure. So that's what you would get if you just assumed that you had spins interacting with each other on sites. If you take the other possible extreme and you look at their system in terms of Hartree-Fock, then you would get this line here, the solid line, which behaves totally differently from the Heisenberg picture. And what you would have in that case is an anti-ferromagnetic region below the solid line and a paramagnetic region above the solid line. But what their Monte Carlo simulations show is kind of different than both, but shows similarity to the two. That's shown by these error bars here. And what they find is a region below these error bars, which is anti-ferromagnetic, and a region above, which is paramagnetic, but still has local spins. And then this shows what the density of states looks like. Over here, it's insulating. So it's an insulating anti-ferromagnetic, it's an anti-ferromagnetic insulator. And then as you come through this region, they have a continuous transition where it becomes an anti-ferromagnetic metal. And then finally over here, it's a paramagnetic metal. So, and then this metal insulator transition goes from this broad thing to a sharp first order transition as you lower the temperature. Now, I really think it may be that this is the type of phase diagram that may be important in these systems like FeO and COO as well. And if you look at the plot, this is from the Bodro et al. Paper. If you look at their nail temperatures versus pressure, you see this is what happens at low pressure. We know the nail temperature increases, so it's anti-ferromagnetic below and ferromagnetic above. And then this is what their measurements show at high pressure. So if you join these together, then you can have something that's very reminiscent of this sort of shape here. And the indication then is that if you raise the temperature at low pressure, you just disorder the spins on the lattice. Okay, so that's the normal nail transition. If you raise the pressure, like in the Pastrnak et al. Experiment, then you also disorder the spins, but you go into the same phase field. It's just you also lose some of the moment maybe as you cross this line. So anyway, that may be the picture of what's going on, and whether that seems to be consistent with what the LDAU is showing in detail, but maybe we don't have the temperature part there. That's just all done at zero temperature. There's one more thing I want to mention, which is experimental shock data on cobalt oxide. very interestingly shows a phase transition at 80 GPA, and they here's the diffraction data for it. It seems to be an isostructural transition. And they pointed to our science paper and our high-spin, low-spin transition, which is predicted to happen at 80 GPA with advanced theory. The problem is, when you do LDA plus U, you get no such phase transition anywhere. Okay, it just remains high-spin. So if they're right, and this is a high-spin, low-spin transition, then it's really more compatible with the conventional band theory than with LDA plus U. So we're really in this very fuzzy situation now. I mean, basically, it's kind of like the experimental situation where you have a lot of data and you don't know how to interpret it. I mean, we have a lot of results now, and there's a lot of experimental data. I think this isn't going to be solved until there's both more theory and more experiments. I mean, really, I think in some way the problem will really be solved by experiment, but we'll by doing the theory kind of at the same time, we'll be able to learn better about how to describe these systems. Really, it's the ideal situation that many people talk about theory and experiment working together to solve a problem. This is really a case where it's maybe needed more than anything else, than any other system I know of, maybe other than hydrogen, say. Okay, so I mentioned all of these things already, so I have a lot of details here, but okay. That's the show. That was my time to talk.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, well, first, I don't know what GDA stands for.
Right, yeah, but it's okay, yeah.
And
it's just a word.
Well, I can explain it if you want. But I said conventional band theory, so it's just the best, or so the right one too. It's just the most accurate current form of density functional theory, where you take gradients of the density into account as well as just the value of the electronic charge density. Mm-hmm. So it stands for generalized gradient approximation. And so basically it's just the best known current solution to density functional problem that doesn't involve anything ad hoc in it. I mean, the LDA plus U in some sense includes more, but it's a model. I mean, it's not, you can't derive, you can derive LDA plus U starting with Hartree-Fock and then saying now you're going to make density functional approximations to the correlation energy to add on to Hartree-Fock. So in principle, you could come at it from that way. As far as I know, nobody's done that. Maybe somebody has now. I mean, so in principle, you could take a Hartree-Fock code and add stuff onto it and end up with something similar also to LDA plus U. But I don't think that's been done. So what we're doing is coming from the conventional band theory side, which does not have these local Hartree-Fock interactions in it, basically. It has just average interactions, the kind of mean field interactions. Another way of looking at the problem, which I didn't even talk about, is a whole other way of looking at it. Some people think it's equivalent, and I can't really judge, but it may be equivalent, though they have totally different looking formalisms. Another way to look at it is imagine you have a hydrogen atom, one electron. Well, in conventional band theory, not band theory, in the conventional density functional theory as it's normally applied, like the LDA or the GGA, you would just have a charge density for that electron. So you wouldn't put it in a point space, you would say it has a probability of being here. Then when you calculate the electrostatic energy, though, you would effectively have an interaction between that electron and itself. I mean, really, it can't. I mean, it's really just in one place, and it can't feel any electrostatic charge from itself. But when you do the way that self-consistent field theory is normally done, it would feel you have a charge density, and you calculate the electrostatic energy for that charge density, it looks like that electron's interacting with itself. So basically, there's a localization problem there. I mean, that's the thing, is that if you have a crystal now, so that's the problem with a single atom. Of course, we know how to solve the hydrogen atom exactly anyway, right? But let's say you have a lattice of hydrogen atoms. So now the problem is you don't know whether to use that self-consistent field picture because maybe the electrons really are moving through the whole crystal like it was a metal. Or maybe they really are stuck at just one site and you shouldn't count their interaction with themselves. So a way of looking at the Mott transition is either whether you should do the mean field solution with self-consistent field, or whether you should not consider the interaction of an electron with itself. So that leads to a whole other set of models called self-interaction corrections. And if you apply those to FEO, they also give an insulating state at zero pressure. Unfortunately, they're computationally much more difficult than the LDA plus U method. And as far as I know, they've never been applied at high pressure. But this would be an ideal case then. In principle then, one could, maybe I'll do this now, but it's probably another 2 years worth of work. Okay, so one could
so it'll be a while before you get the answers. But one could go through and do what's known as SIC or SIC calculations on the same system, compare with the LDA plus U and see where they make different predictions. Presumably they do, because they have different looking formula, I mean. And then hopefully the experiments will get worked out by then, and we can say the right way to do it is this, or neither of the above, or both of them give the same result. Actually, it'd be nice if they both get the same result, and the experiments get the same result too, you know. That would be really good. But it may not happen that way, you know. And then there's a whole other set of methods that are being developed, which are even more complicated, known as dynamical mean field theory. And in fact, Savrasov, who I'm working with on this, is actually one of the foremost people in that area, and the code I'm using actually does that. But unfortunately, it makes the calculations another maybe say 100 times harder to do. And so right now, it's just not, I mean, we could do FEO at zero pressure with it, but to do the whole pressure range is probably not, and certainly with all the strains and everything, it's just not feasible right now. But what it does is it takes into account the frequency dependence of the interactions. So that's why it's called dynamical mean field theory. So right now, this LDA plus U is essentially a static approximation. I mean, the electrons are either localized or they're not. But with the dynamical mean field theory, you have essentially like a dynamical hopping of the electrons between the atoms, and you can actually have a phase transition between a band state and a localized state. And nobody knows yet how the predictions of that model, even for any system, even at zero pressure, compares with LDA plus U. I mean, there's been very little done with it yet, you know, in terms of, even though there's like reviews in modern physics articles on it, boy, this hasn't been applied to many real systems yet. It's been applied mainly to idealized systems, like the Hubbard model.
Okay, and Sandro Scandolo presented is LDA, right?
Yes.
Without density gradients.
I don't know. I think you're right. I think what he showed was just LDA. So the LDA and the GGA give similar results for many systems. And the main difference in the GGA is it tends to give better lattice parameters. So the equations of state tend to be better. But for some systems, LDA is pretty good. And it's a GGA, since you have to compute all these gradients, you have to compute up to fourth order gradients. So it's just computationally more time consuming. And it's also more unstable numerically. So if you're doing like what he was doing with dynamics, it's just less stable, because you can imagine, you have denominators of gradients in the theory. And so the gradient sometimes goes to zero. So then you have to step off of that. But you can see if you're actually doing electrodynamics, that can cause problems. But actually for hydrogen, it's known that GGA gives much better results than LDA. Okay, so if you're looking at something like hydrogen or even methane or something, it's quite possible that they'll give different predictions of phase transition pressures.
But is there a difference between solids and liquids, that method?
In principle, you could do GGA for liquids as well as for solids. And it should be a similar kind of problem. Most of the correction in the GGA is deep in the atom, so it shouldn't matter whether it's a liquid or a solid. I mean, what GGA does in a very simple-minded way is change the size of atoms, because it gets the interactions better in the regions that have sharp gradients. And the regions that have sharp gradients are as you get in towards the nucleus and so forth, so it really changes things a lot there. In fact, it gives the wrong answer as you approach the nucleus. It gives a divergent potential, so some people don't like it on just aesthetic grounds. Too divergent, I mean more than one for R. Anyway, so people are working on improved things there too. There's something now known as a weighted density approximation, which essentially gives perfect lattice parameters. So it gives like to six figures, it's almost getting to like where they can get in particle physics and produce numbers exactly. But again, the computational burden becomes so great, as far as I know, that's only been used to get zero pressure lattice parameters for a small number of systems. So nobody's ever tried to even do equation state with it.
The main difference in the liquid state theory calculations of the type that Scandolo does is that you have to take the output of the quantum mechanical calculation and fit it to a potential. So there's an intervening empirical step where you say that the results of your calculation can be represented as a set of potentials. And you have to realize that there's a potential error in that step, separate from whatever approximations you make with the quantum mechanics.
Well, and really, any sort of band type calculation doesn't pertain to liquid state. I mean, this came up in the first week when we were talking about liquid hydrogen versus all of the thinking that's been done on crystalline forms of hydrogen.
Well, you can assume periodic boundary conditions, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean,
quantum mechanics, there's always error associated with that.
Yeah, the box theorem is immensely powerful.
In principle, you can converge it. I mean, the only case where you can't is if you have like there's some questions about electrically active materials like ferroelectrics. I mean, and even there, you can do it under the zero fuel limit. But for hydrogen, it should be okay. I mean, if you have a big enough supercell, so the question is just convergence of the supercell size. I mean, in ionic liquids, it actually looks like it works okay there too, but there's even more of a problem there because then you have long-range interactions between atoms. But there's of course a whole other approach for liquids that, self-consistent field theories for liquids that would go beyond that. But I don't know if anybody ever applied that in the first principles.
Well, there is of course a first principles liquid theory, but it's computationally horrendous. That's what Dave Zeppelin does.
Right.
That's the quantum Monte Carlo.
Yeah, but he also,
that's as close as you can get to first principles. But
yeah, but he has a periodic supercell.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, so you have to make the cell large and hope that those consequences, the consequences of doing that, are small.
I mean,
but it's a supercell. That's right.
Yeah, but you have to have boundary conditions. I mean, in principle, you can do the same thing on a finite thing. Yeah. But if he does that on, say, I don't know what his system size is right now, but let's say 16 hydrogen atoms, if there weren't periodic boundary conditions, then it would just be 16 hydrogen atoms. So there would be no reason to think that would behave like the bulk system at all, right? But actually, it's an interesting problem. I mean, somebody should look at the behavior of, finite. I mean, that's one way to test your supercell effect, is to look at what happens in the finite limit and different size supercells.
Yeah, and I think there are good indications of problems. I mean, people who look at multi-layer structures and quantum wells and all this kind of stuff, that's their business. So it's a rich area. I'm not saying this as a criticism. I think there's a lot of rich physics to be done there.
How big a system has it gone up to?
I don't recall either. I would hesitate. I know my reaction as an experimentalist, it's always incredibly tiny, but that's a prejudicial point of view. Those are pioneering calculations.
Somebody's pushing up 128 particles, but yeah. that's the computation about as far as it's possible to go to. With the classical Monte Carlo simulation that we do on the charged particles with a uniform background, we can go up to over 1,000 particles. And then, but the error is roughly 1 over n.
But I think that, he should be sensitive to H2 versus H. I mean, even with a pretty small sample size. So, but whether he gets the exact right structure for H2, Albert, is another story. I mean, an exact transition, I guess, may be in the wrong place. If he doesn't have the right structure for either of them.
From discussions with Scandolo, it seemed to me that the LDA approximation, for liquids maybe, was quite good, except when you have interacting molecules, atoms, like in van der Waals theory. Would you agree on that? Or?
Quite good always depends on what you're expecting to see. I mean, it's not an experimental accuracy, certainly. I mean, you can't just, I think it's usually pretty indicative of what's going on. I showed examples last week of predictions that were, right on. But, there's certainly plenty of cases like these, basically anything with the transition, with a 3D transition metal ions in it, not just FeO or COO, has these same kind of problems like I'm talking about here. Like all the IP superconductors and all that stuff have the same, and these ruthenates and everything have similar sorts of problems of what I was talking about for these systems. So if you start asking, like, putting in transition metals into the mix, then certainly it's not true that it's okay. you know, it's okay, maybe, but I mean, we don't know yet. But for the, you know, for the simple materials, like he was talking, like methane or something like that, I mean, it's probably pretty good, but we know it's not good at low densities. So then you start having very important long range, you know, like you said, Van der Waals and others.
Yeah, it's not captured Van der Waals.
But if he's looking at very high densities, you know, most people think that that's quenched. I mean, that the interactions are gone. So if you look at methane at, you know, megabar, you know, the theory probably is okay, but actually we wouldn't know that without comparing the experiment, really. I mean, you know, because there's still the possibility that it doesn't pick up everything. And then there's the other problem in that is just the classical assumption of the dynamics. Now, he's got, I mean, I wish he was here, but anyway, he said that he doesn't think there's any quantum effects, you know, for the hydrogen dynamics at those compressions, but I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, certainly for ice, you know, for ice 10 or whatever, I mean, in that pressure range, you would think that there is some quantum effect on where that transition is for the asymmetric, you know, transition, asymmetric transition in ice.
At room temperature.
At room temperature.
At room temperature. Yeah, yeah.
But if you got up in temperature.
He's trying to explain things at 7,000.
Right. Right. So if you got high enough in temperature, maybe there's no quantum effects there anymore. Mm-hmm. But you have to remember also the entropy integrates over the whole temperature range. So it may move a phase boundary, you know, even if the dynamics is really dominated classically. The other thing, I mean, the temperature has to be pretty high, you know, for hydrogen before you completely classify. Right? Depends on the energetics of the system.
Well, of course, the problem that I'm thinking of is the actually the problem of the phase separation of helium in hydrogen.
Yeah. Because
the latest calculations are from LDA calculations by Pfeifenzeller et al. In 95. And I believe this is something that could be redone more accurately.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And
I tried to get money to do that, and the review panel said it wasn't important. Anyway, so what was in 95 was the last time?
Yeah. Fizarev lectures or something like that?
Yeah. But you know, the real issue there, as I see it, is you've got to be able to do hydrogen well. I mean, you can't even talk about doing a hydrogen helium system well until you really know that you've done the hydrogen well.
Yeah.
Because it's going to depend on the electronic states of the hydrogen as to how soluble helium is.
Yeah, well, I
agree. In the dilute limit.
But the next best thing we
I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just pointing out why it's such a difficult problem. Yeah, I agree completely that Pfeifenzeller is not good enough, because I don't think they're doing a good enough job on pure hydrogen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But so the other estimate of a phase diagram is from fully ionized plasma calculation, and as
well. No, I think that's even less reliable.
And yeah, that's my point. So a basic question, is that okay? the basic problem is the problem of the slope I have of this. May I have a transparent? Basically, if you have pressure and temperature, fully ionized calculations would predict a critical temperature like that. So here you have helium. And the other calculations, the other calculations are somewhere
Yeah, and do the calculation, but somewhere like that. So that's the NDA talking better. And when you calculate a temperature profile inside Jupiter and Saturn, it's something like that.
So it's really important to understand whether we should expect something that way or that kind of flow, because it changes completely where you would expect hydrogen to unmixing of hydrogen inside those planets.
So is that difference understood? I mean, is it just like the volume effect of specific partial molar volumes of helium and hydrogen that are totally different in the two cases?
Well, it must be thermodynamically.
Yeah.
So. No, it's a quantum mechanical effect that's driving the separation. It's not the...
No, but I mean, the slope is really different there.
The slope's opposite.
So maybe that's testable.
Separately.
Using a more exact
That's right. That's an interesting idea.
Yeah, the problem is that those calculations haven't been done to pressures that are high enough so that they should recover.
The LDA curve will must bend over.
Yeah.
Must.
Yes, because
I don't think there's any dispute on that. I think, frankly, although this is speculation, it's also got to be run at low pressure, because I don't think they've done the correct thing at.
Maybe it's wrong.
There I'm not so sure. But
okay. Maybe it's not even the right LDA result. Right? Need to look at that.
Why do you say it has to bend over? I'm not disagreeing. I'm not sure what you're logic.
Because we have no basis for thinking that the system is different from OCP at sufficiently high pressures.
Okay.
I mean, really, really high pressures. Maybe it's 100 megabars or something.
Yeah,
really high pressures. It's got to go to that.
Was it investigated experimentally, this separation, or is
This is all theory, and there isn't any useful experiment.
What's the pressure where they cross there?
They did the calculation till
4 megabars.
That would be the end of the curve. And frankly, this curve is...
A comment. Bill Hubbard and I, back in the early 80s, did a Monte Carlo study of protons and alpha particles in a responding background of electrons using linear response theory. And, of course, not very many particles, and we could limit about 108, I think, was the best we do, divided between protons and electrons. We tried to get the internal energy and Helmholtz free energy for various mixtures of protons and alpha particles. And we did construct a very rough phase diagram and got some estimate of where the helium would separate out of the hydrogen. Probably not very realistic at all. By now it's really old hat, but it's on the upper end of that core high pressure toward 100 megabar area. And Hubbard was saying, well, it may have something to do with Jupiter, because that's, after all, the electron density around a neutral helium atom is roughly the same as the kind of electron density we're getting around the alpha particles. I don't think it's a very good argument, but anyway, this was essentially just an OCP calculation stretched to include responding electrons in the linear response theory, and it's at that tie-in of high pressure. Really, that doesn't have much to do with Jupiter, because Jupiter is more like 10 megahertz or so. And as far as I know, the helium in Jupiter is neutral.
That's right.
And so that's going to be the harder question, how to separate neutral helium from ionized hydrogen, which we can't touch.
To me, well,
so there is something else we know on the diagram, and that is that the separation over here, meaning well below megabar, is below the 80 bar for Jupiter. Mm-hmm. I mean, we actually know this. This is an experiment.
Yeah.
There is an experiment.
Yeah.
And so the question is whether the curve does this or whether it does this. And so I think there's got to be a peak. It's got to be a peak in this curve. Yes. And the question is, where does it peak? Does it peak in megabar, 5 megabar, 10 megabar? That's the thing we're doing. And I think that it's easy. I mean, I did calculations like this back in the mid-70s and did have a slope like this. It's easy to understand, and I even have a paper I published where I have a line that looks like this, based on super potential theory. It's easy to understand why this theory is wrong, and Hugh said that it's because helium is actually neutral rather than fully ionized, yes, on Jupiter. As for this one, I don't know, but I worry about it because I don't think they're treating hydrogen well enough. And the crucial question is, where do you start to get conduction electrons? And if you're not doing a good enough job of hydrogen, you can't answer that question. You've got to have, basically, you've got to solve the plasma phase transition question. That's what it comes down to. I mean, if you haven't solved that question, you don't have a hope of solving the question of helium.
What about the variable the blood pressure in that we need to experiment? Experiments in that? I
mean, at really low pressure, yeah. Yes.
So
yes, so there is a miscibility gap in the H2 helium system, and the critical temperature is similar to the melting point of hydrogen. I don't remember the exact numbers, but you know, it roughly scales. In other words, right. There's a miscibility gap, but only just. It's a weak effect, and it has to do with the difference in the size of the molecules. It's a very standard physical chemistry effect that you see in many mixtures where the two species are chemically similar, which of course will be true until you get to the place where hydrogen wants to do something different.
But that hasn't been followed up to
neighbor. It hasn't been followed up to neighbor, and that should be done too, although it's not, you'd like people to do that. It's not likely to be directly the answer to the question of what's happening in Jupiter, but it would be a piece of the puzzle. Especially if you can start to get into the region where things are happening. I also think that connectivity, that is Phil Mellis's experiments, in principle could help, because if you could dope those experiments with helium, you might see the effect of the helium on the onset of conduction. And I think of that as a proxy for the repulsive interaction between the conduction electrons and helium, which I believe is what drives the insolubility. Mm-hmm. So what I would predict in Bill Nellis's experiment is that if he could dope his hydrogen with helium, he would see a suppression of the onset of conductivity. It would not be as conducting as he sees with pure hydrogen. And if you understood the conductivity mechanism well enough, you could even model the results of Bill Nellis's experiment to extract from his experimental results this repulsive interaction, which you could then put into
There may not be time for unmixing.
That's not my point.
Okay.
No, it doesn't have to unmix.
Okay.
The phase transition, the phase separation is being driven by the repulsive interaction between neutral helium atoms and free electrons. If you are in a regime where it has not phase separated, or even if you're metastably in a regime that wants to phase separate, in either case, the system will adjust to this repulsive interaction. If you write down a free energy, you see immediately why this is so. It'll adjust so as to suppress the number of conduction electrons. So it'll lower the conductivity. This is a simple picture, and I'm not sure it's right, but that's a way to think about it. So it would seem to be quite likely that you could get a reduction in the number of carriers because the helium suppresses that.
I mean, in the case of FeO and iron, your conductivity for FeO looked very similar to that of iron, yeah. Right? So I don't know how much difference the helium is going to make in the conductivity.
I don't know either. What I do know, though, is that in order to explain the immiscibility that we think is happening in Jupiter, the delta Gibbs energy that's driving this process is several electron volts per helium atom.
What do you mean?
If you put that into a typical free energy model, it's not a first principles of model, obviously, but yeah, you know, you put in pieces of the free energy that have the ability to create a plasma phase transition, like the Gilles Chabrier model. If you then insert a term like that, it will suppress the number of electrons, free electrons, dramatically.
What do you mean by the system will adjust? What does that physically mean? I'm just quoting you. I'm still trying to understand the answer that you were giving me, like 5 minutes ago. You said the system will adjust so as to suppress the conductivity. This is in the helium hydrogen system that is metastably, it's metastable, but trying to unmix. And you said it will adjust. I'm just trying to understand what you mean by that. What does that mean?
In free energy models of the type that Gilles Chabrier computes, what he does is he writes down a free energy, he's got a bunch of interaction terms. Among them, there are terms that are a measure of how much dissociation of hydrogen molecules there are and how much production of free electrons there is. If I then take his free energy and just add one piece, which is a plus delta G, which is a large term, several electron volts, times the number of electrons, free electrons in the system, times the number of helium atoms, which represents the interaction of conduction carriers with helium atoms, and then re-minimize the free energy. It's a variational principle. So you minimize the energy with respect to number of free electrons, number of dissociation. Then you will shift the number of free electrons to a dramatically lower value for the simple reason that putting free electrons into the system raises the free energy through the interaction of the free electrons with the helium atoms. It's an undesirable term in the free energy. So it's really a very simple thing. So we have some free energy, which is the free energy of hydrogen, which has a bunch of parameters, which includes X, the number of free electrons. And what Gilles does, of course, is he minimizes the free energy with respect to that parameter at each volume and temperature. This is the standard procedure for any sort of chemical model of free energy. And I'm just saying, and in this term, which represents, actually it's slightly more complicated than this, because it depends on the electron density, but just to get the point across, let me write it this way. Which represents the this is a large term, several electron volts. So if I add in that term, what that does is it shifts the minimum to a smaller x because of this repulsive term. The important thing is that this is a big term. So you've got fewer electrons.
To come back to those calculations, I guess that at least one should be able to understand, even without a correct model of hydrogen at 1 or 2 megabars, going to 10 megabars, understanding what the slope is when you add a helium atom, is it easier at high pressures or at low pressures, that should be possible to do reasonably.
So
depends.
Well,
up to you guys.
Good now.
Do a lunch and then come back and start again?
We could do that if people like. It's actually an earlier break than what we normally do.
Well, it's going to either be earlier or later. That's what
I'm going to do. How long are you going to talk?
As long as you guys want. It's, I was going to give some of the background for why people have been interested in the formula boundary. And I was not going to actually talk about any of the experiments or the FEO or any of that stuff.
That was good now.